Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, the right side of history. The riot at New York's Stonewall Inn in June 1969 is often cited as the event that triggered the modern queer rights movement. It was a pivotal moment, a night when gay and transgender women and men refused to tolerate another night of police harassment and rejected it violently. That moment, however, was not the first such moment, nor the last. It was but one of many in LGBT progress, and there have been many heroes before and after. Our guests tonight are going to tell us about some of those moments and about their personal roles in some of them. They'll also tell us about some of the other heroes who came before and after them, from Isadora Duncan, the free-spirited communist bisexual dancer of the early 20th century, to Josephine Baker, Bayard Rustin, Harvey Milk, and today's heroes. Adrian Brooks is the editor of the new anthology, The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism, and he wrote several of the essays in this anthology. Adrian originally is from Philadelphia. He's a longtime activist, poet, performer, playwright, painter, novelist, and nonfiction writer. He describes himself as an early hippie and anti-war protester. He attended a radical Quaker school, the Friends World Institute, intent on its students becoming nonviolent agents of social change. And in 1968, he was a very active volunteer in Martin Luther King's civil rights organization before that leader's assassination. From 1970 to 72, Brooks was part of the nascent Soho scene in New York. He knew Andy Warhol, who cast him in a film. He moved to California in 1972, began writing poetry, became prominent in the gay liberation movement here, organized what may have been the first public gay poetry reading in 1974, and was a playwright and performer with the Angels of Light, an offshoot of the legendary Coquettes from 1974 to 1980. There's much more to say about him, and I know he'll have plenty to say himself, so for now I will stop and say, Adrian Brooks, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you very much.
Adrian will be our guide this hour, so I'll have him introduce the very special guest he has brought with him, one of the many contributors to Adrian's anthology, The Right Side of History.
Again, thank you. It's really a pleasure for us to be here. I'm here tonight with Max Wolf Valerio, who is the author of an amazing book titled The Testosterone Files, which documents and chronicles his incredible journey from being born female, half Native American and half Hispanic, becoming a radical lesbian, then realizing that it wasn't working for him and that he needed to go through gender reassignment surgery in order to become the heterosexual man that he is. So it was quite extraordinary for me to meet him in the course of doing this book, and I'm very happy that he's here tonight.
Thank you both so much for being here, Max. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, Adrian, why don't you start by reading a passage from the introduction to your book and sort of lays out for the reader and the listener what it's all about.
The introduction begins with a picture of the Pride Parade in San Francisco, but then it flashes back almost immediately to pay respect to some of the people who came before. And this is the passage I'll read. In the 19th century, Walt Whitman was charred as obscene for celebrating the comrade's long-dwelling kiss. Emerson's journals reveal his inchoate passion for a fellow at Harvard. Thoreau swoons for boys bathing at Hubbard's Bend, their skin a pale pink, which the nation would soon tan. And besotted with the splendid but heterosexual Nathaniel Hawthorne, Melville confessed, the soft ravishments of the man spun me around in a web of dreams. The more I contemplate him, and further shoots his strong New England roots into the hot soil of my southern soul. Even revered leaders invite query. After living with 22-year-old Abraham Lincoln in 1831, a year during which they shared a small bed, Billy Green called Lincoln's thighs as perfect as a human being's could be. From 1837 to 1841, Lincoln lived with a handsome merchant, Joshua Speed. They, too, had a double bed. Thereafter, Lincoln ended some of his letters, "Yours forever." And whenever his wife was away, from September 1862 to April 1863, Lincoln shared his bed and a nightshirt with Army Captain David Derrickson, a fact that provoked Washington gossip. Was it to distance with humor, then? Or was it to tease his critics that our 18th century wrote a poem with these lines? For Reuben and Charles have married two girls, but Billy has married a boy. The girls he had tried on every side, but none he could get to agree. All was in vain. He went home again, and since that, he's married to Natty. Lincoln's sexuality may never be conclusively untangled, but the first woman to run for president in 1872 was a fearless advocate of free love. In an 1871 speech, Victoria Hull stated, "I have an unalienable constitutional and natural right to love whom I may, to love as long or as short a period as I can, to change that love every day if I please, and with that right neither you nor any law you can frame have any right to interfere, and I have the further right to demand a free and unrestricted exercise of that right, and it is your duty not only to accord it, but as a community, to see that I am protected in it. I trust that I am fully understood, for I mean just that."
That's Adrian Brooks reading from his anthology, the introduction of his anthology, The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. I'm Eric Jansen. Adrian and Max Wolf-Valerio are my guests this evening. So this image of Abraham Lincoln sharing a nightshirt, I'm like, how do you share a nightshirt? Is that an expression they used at the time?
I don't know. I guess it has something to do with how big the nightshirt is.
And Melville and Thoreau, and that was kind of hot stuff in those days. I mean, for that time, the phrasing, the words they used. But what is your point in bringing in these figures from, you know, from before the turn of the century?
I think it's very, very important for all people, in this case Americans, to understand that our history is not the history simply of gay white men who are property owners. Homosexuals, bisexuals, lesbians, such as Susan B. Anthony, were active and completely engaged, especially from the early 19th century on. And it's a huge injustice and just ethically wrong for anyone to assume that liberation in this country began with white people, or that it's the province of heterosexuals who are graciously bestowing it of their own free will. It's been vigorously asserted and indeed claimed and taken by underdogs in our society.
And to assume that it began with Stonewall, which is so recent, really.
I think one of the great things that we have to be proud of in this country is that our founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and the Constitution, were written by revolutionaries, and they were not declared as finished documents, but rather as a work in progress. And that as people have grown into our own ideals as a nation, we keep coming to new understandings. And I think it's very important that those values are asserted with each generation and that we keep changing and living up to them.
Thank you. So, Max Wolf-Valerio, you have two essays in this book, The Right Side of History, and one of them, which Adrian alluded to in his beginning, was about your change and transformation, and it's called The Enemy Is Me. Yeah. And it's about your reception or perhaps, well, maybe I shouldn't give any more away. What would you like to let us know before you read this passage?
Well, it's titled The Enemy Is Me, Becoming a Man Inside a Feminist World. And so it's basically I take excerpts from the testosterone files and I kind of wrote around them and fleshed them out with the focus of talking about having been a lesbian feminist in the second wave going into the third wave. And, you know, my struggle with finding, you know, my male identity in the midst of what was at that time a very anti-male world. So
Yeah, I do recall the since we're about the same age, I certainly recall the 70s and 80s and 60s even, when maleness was, challenged in various ways, let's just say.
Yeah.
And I sort of spent a lot of time within feminist lesbian circles in Santa Cruz. Anyway, please do read this passage.
Okay, so I will start out taking this from the middle of the essay. And it's situated at the University of Colorado when I came out, my first coming out, which was as a lesbian in 1975 when I was 18 at the University of Colorado. And so when I came out in 1975, we all sat in a circle and introduced ourselves one by one at the meeting of the Lesbian Caucus of the Women's Liberation Front on campus. Women didn't just state their names. They always had lengthy rejoinders, subtle anthems. Hi, I'm Sally, and I'm a socialist feminist, not a separatist. Hi, I'm Naomi, and I am a socialist feminist who is against imperialism in all its forms. Hi, I'm Nadine. I am a lesbian separatist and a member of the ISIS Women's Community Orchestra. We are trying to demystify the process of music making and clarify our struggles with class and women's oppression. When it came to me, 18 years old, green, just arrived on campus, looking at the first really out lesbians I had seen in my entire life, I was scared to death. What to say? An impish impulse in me thought, what if I say I'm a Republican and I like girls? No, that wouldn't do. That much was clear. The second wave of lesbian feminism didn't sit well with me for long. Once I hit San Francisco in the late 70s, I was doing all the things you weren't supposed to do. Dyeing my hair black or bleaching it, wearing black leather and chains, listening to aggressive male punk bands, dating women who liked to wear dresses, heels, and makeup. Hanging out with people who were not always politically fluent, but were artistically in the crevices and edges. I had many straight male friends, and because of my predilection for arcane outsider art and avant-garde poetry, I was soon giving poetry readings to audiences of edgy literati and neo-beats instead of reading exclusively in feminist bookstores and cafes. In no time flat, I found myself preferring Black Flag, Joy Division, and X over Holly Near, Alex Dobkin, or Chris Williamson. Possibly, before I even considered medical transition in 1988, I had already left. Without question, second-wave lesbian feminists were very brave and changed the world in many ways for the better. They expanded the roles and lives of women and of men in concrete, tangible ways. Let there be no mistake. The world before second-wave feminism was a world where men and women had separate help-wanted columns in the daily newspaper, where women often could not get a credit card without a husband's signature, where women and girls were not encouraged to participate in sports, and where battered women were not protected by shelters, where marital rape was legal. I want to make it clear that while there were excesses from the second wave, there were also necessary triumphs. Some of the excesses of the second wave were issues built into having the worldview of a collective identity locked in struggle with another group, a Marxist paradigm of struggle between competing classes, in this case, women against men, and further, essential femaleness against essential masculinity and maleness. Ironically, just as my own mother had been critical of my masculinity, the world of feminism had also. In my search for liberation from restrictive norms, I had simply traded one disapproving mother figure for another. At some point, I had to ask, what was this maleness, this masculinity, and was it really as bad as I had been told? Taking on biological maleness, masculinity, and the increasingly embattled mantle of manhood has not been an entirely easy transformation. Like a high school finishing school for women, being a lesbian in the age of feminism had certain rules, taboos, things you said and did not say. And certainly one of them was that men and women were capable of the same things, but of course, men were oppressors. I had been told that my feelings of being male were bad and wrong my entire life, first by the entire society around me, and then by the world I had escaped to for solace, the world of lesbianism cloaked by feminism.
That's great. That's Max Wolf Valeria reading from his essay, The Enemy Is Me, in The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. I'm Eric Jansen. Max and the editor of this anthology, Adrian Brooks, are my guests tonight on Out in the Bay. Now, towards the end of this essay, it sounds like you talk about the sort of the individuality that all of us have. And as you started taking hormone treatments, you know, walked down the street and felt finally in kinship with other men in a way that I guess what I'm stumbling around here trying to say is after having so many years of having identified the male as the oppressor, you come to a sort of summary of we're each individual people, so let's not reject one aspect of any person. Just for that reason.
Yeah. I had to really, and I go into that in the next section, which I can maybe read later. But basically, I had to really struggle with a lot of these received ideas about masculinity in men in order to really become a man and feel affirmed in that. And eventually, yes, you do come to a place. I mean, I sort of thought of things that way before, but you do come to a place where you're like, okay, of course, we're all people and so on. But it was more than that. I had to come to a place of celebrating and embracing masculinity and manhood. It wasn't just, oh, we're all people and we're all individuals, which, of course, is true. Yeah, that's the basic truth. But I had to go further than that. And so I had to, you know, at some point I begin to see things from a different perspective, which is really what the testosterone files is about. And it's really about the testosterone and how it affected me, which I talk about a little bit in the essay. I definitely is the, you know, one of the things in the essay that's there. And it really changed how I view the world, not only how people view me, but how I view the world. So really the sex change isn't so much the gender transition, isn't so much the surgery, though that's important, but it really is the hormones. Mm-hmm. The hormones are really what change a person.
So tell us a little bit more about the testosterone files. That's a book that you wrote how many years ago?
Oh, gosh. I wrote that in the mid-90s, most of it. So it's really about the first 5 years of my transition because it's been 26 years for me. So I started in 1989 on testosterone. I started thinking about it beforehand. But so it's really about those first 5 years, and it's about the journey, the transformational journey of taking testosterone, exactly what it does in terms of physically what it did to me. Psychologically, there were changes. There were changes in my perception, even my sense of smell, my sex drive, my emotional volatility. I experienced not being able to cry as easily or as much. There were all these things that changed, many of which I did not expect. So you're really with me in this journey as it's happening. I'm trying to recreate it, kind of immerse the reader in the experience, and in this transformation. And it was very challenging to me.
I can imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, this is maybe getting a little bit off the subject of what I really wanted to get into, but I'm really curious about how has the trans movement taught all of us to look at gender differently in a very similar way that I think the gay and lesbian rights movement challenged perhaps straight people to think about, or all of us to think about our gender roles, our sex, roles like, the men take out the garbage and the women do the dishes, that kind of thing. Do you see a similarity there? And to me it seems like it's almost an extension. It's taking that to another level to think that, there is not necessarily this binary of male and female.
Well, kind of what I discovered in the testosterone files, what I kind of discovered there is a binary, right? And that's sort of the interesting, the contrary and the controversial thing about the book is that as I went into it, I discovered there really is a binary. And that, I was going from one thing to another, in a sense, because of the hormones. And, which isn't to say that it's a rigid binary, but that there really are differences between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I was like, wow, now I see why certain things, like, for example, why men are more into pornography, or, why when I'd be arguing with my male friends before, I might be more apt in the in my previous life, even though I thought of myself as pretty tough and pretty strong, I might be more apt to burst into tears.
Right.
Whereas now I just, that never happens.
Interesting.
You know?
Okay.
Yeah. So there are all these things that changed. And my sense of smell changed. Of course, my body odor changed. And of course, the way people treated me changed.
Sure.
But so it really was more instructive in terms of there actually is a binary.
Okay.
Right.
That's Max Wolf Valerio. He's one of my guests this evening on Out in the Bay. Talking about his book, The Testosterone Files. He's also has an essay, two essays actually. One of them, The Enemy Is Me, which he just read from in The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. And the editor of this anthology, Adrian Brooks, is also here this evening. Where can folks learn more about this book? I know it's on Amazon's website, and you can also search online for the title or for Adrian Brooks, author, and it will come up. Is it available at local bookstores as well, Adrian?
I think so.
Okay, well, we'll hope so. Go out there and ask for it.
Okay.
Well, one way you can get this book is by contributing to KALW at the $120 level during this hour, this membership campaign's only airing of Out in the Bay. Hi, I'm Eric Jansen here this evening live in the studio. This conversation with Max and Adrian was recorded on Tuesday night. The number to call is 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917, or go online to kalw.org. And The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism, can be yours for a donation of $120. Of course, the basic membership level is $50. Any level you can give to support KALW and Out in the Bay at this time would be so appreciated. KALW is dear to me for many reasons. One is that it took a chance on Out in the Bay. KALW is the station that said yes 11 years ago. You can show your support for KALW and Out in the Bay now. Again, the phone number is 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. Or go online to kalw.org. There are many potential gifts you can choose from if you choose to have one. Now back to our interview with my guests, Adrian Brooks and Max Wolf Valerio. So, Max, I wanted to ask you, you read that excerpt before from The Enemy Is Me, and you talked about coming out in 1975 and in the circle of women who all had to have a very specific label attached after their name. I'm just curious to know where you went to college and where you had grown up. You know, kind of what your what background you were coming from to arrive at this college and these first time seeing a real life lesbian.
Right. Yeah, well, I went to school at University of Colorado in Boulder, and I went out to San Francisco in 1977. I left school early and kind of on an adventure to go to San Francisco, and I just stayed out here. I got sucked into San Francisco and into adventures here. I grew up all over the place. That's kind of a hard question to answer where I'm from because my father was in the military. He was career military for 20 years. So I was born in Germany in an army hospital, and we lived all over the United States and in Europe, again in Germany, Frankfurt, Germany. And we also lived in San Francisco, but we lived all over. And my father retired in Colorado when I was like 14.
Okay, so that's why you ended up in Colorado.
Yeah.
Not specifically to go away to go to college.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So when you came out and went through this transition and finally realized, oh, I have to maybe reject isn't quite the word, but you had to get away from the lesbian feminist movement in order to become yourself. Did you lose most of your friends, some of your friends? Did you remain close with any of these lesbian feminists?
Well, I think I was basically somebody, I've always been somebody who was in a lot of different worlds at the same time. I became a Tibetan Buddhist for a while. I was into the punk rock thing. I was definitely into punk. And I was in the poet's world. So in the world of poetry that had nothing to do with any particular political movement. And so I had enough, I was lucky enough, I think that provided a window for me outside to leave that world. So I didn't lose, I really didn't lose friends, you know, because I also kind of associated with people who were weirdos and outsiders in those particular worlds. I think there was some whispering behind my back, you know, but I was lucky that people came through it for the most part. So, yeah.
Okay. So, Adrian, there's this, first of all, I just want to let This book, The Right Side of History, has, I'm just like, what, something like 30 chapters. Chapters on 30 different topics, and some are from people I've never heard of or about people I've never heard of, Charlotte Bunch, for example. But one is another local hero and national hero, Miss Major. Can you tell us a little bit about her? And you're going to read a little bit from her essay as well. She was actually a participant in Stonewall, the Stonewall riots.
Miss Major Griffin Gracie has indeed become a national heroine, and for very good reason. Before Stonewall, she was a dancer at a place called the Jewel Box Review. She and a couple other transgender women of color were activists. They were getting young kids off the street, two of them in particular, Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, would hustle to make money to feed and shelter young runaways who were vulnerable, and they would sell their bodies so that these kids wouldn't be victimized. Miss Major is a lifelong activist. She was recently honored by President Obama at the White House with a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I'm very proud to say that she and I have become good friends. She's a great lady. And one of the real delights for me as a writer, and writers tend to be holed up in our cave working, it's a very solitary life, was to have my consciousness expanded by becoming friends with transgender people like Max and Miss Major. For me, this is really the cutting edge of where the LGBT movement is right now and is going. It's wonderful that gay people, lesbians, have achieved equal rights, but it's really an extraordinary opportunity for the expanding of the national consciousness to have transgender people coming into the forefront and claiming their rightful place. The part of the book that I'm going to read now was written by Miss Major, and it concerns the night of Stonewall. She was there, and you'll find out what happened.
Go ahead, please.
The night of Stonewall, two friends and I sat in Sheraton Square talking with the boys, trying to have a good time. Some were talking about Judy Garland, who had just died. Some were talking about a party. Sylvia Rivera was talking about a group she was trying to start, a trans group for girls who worked the street, street transvestite action revolutionaries. Finally, we went to the bar. Not long afterwards, we heard the nightsticks and the lights came on. It was a weird feeling. Everyone just looked at each other this time. The police poked us in the back as they issued us toward the front door. Up the street, there was a paddy wagon. Cops were there. Some girls were already inside. Others inside the bar were refusing to be frisked. Then there was a loud crash. Some said someone threw a shoe or a beer bottle. Some said it was the boys standing around, spectators, raising all kinds of commotion. Some said the cops tried to beat up one of the lesbians and she fought back, which is when all hell broke loose. We started fighting. I could hear people screaming. I heard some guy tell the cops, "Don't hit me in my face," and thought I should just turn and knock him out myself. So I turned back and spit in the face of that cop, and he knocked me out, and that's all I remember. I woke up in the Tombs. It was a jail. At the jail, they kept us all together. I woke up when it was getting light. Everyone was talking about what had happened, and that it had continued, that it hadn't stopped with us. It felt kind of good not to take that shit anymore. They let us out in the morning at 10:30 or 11 a.m., and that night we went back to Stonewall. We didn't know where anyone was. We didn't know who was still in the Tombs or where our friends were. I didn't find some for days. A couple of girls who hadn't been arrested took friends home and helped them heal, gave them baths, gave them clothes. I lived uptown at 85th in Amsterdam and didn't know what was happening for a few days. Most trans girls didn't like the village. Anyway, the people down there, who were mainly white and middle class, weren't nice to us trans girls. That's why we went to the Stonewall Bar in the first place. The most amazing thing for me out of all this is that the movement had a meeting to decide whether they should put T into this political thing of LGB. Why even vote on it? It should have been there from the beginning. I don't understand why the T shouldn't have been the first letter because of Stonewall riots, because we were the ones who were out front before they took it, stole it, like they do everything else in this country. But now we're rising again, and we aren't going anywhere. There are no closets to hide in. We burned the house down.
Very nice. Thank you. That's Adrian Brooks, editor, reading Miss Major Griffin Gracie's essay about Stonewall in the book The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. What quick question for you. We were hoping that she would be here tonight in person. I know she couldn't be, and the hot weather, I don't blame her. She needs a rest. It's hot, and she's been around for a long time, and she deserves a rest. So I hope she's feeling better.
She deserves a crown, and she's earned it.
Yes, and she has indeed. So I looked up her Wikipedia entry when I was preparing for this, and there's a little section here that says, Griffin Gracie believed that at the time she and her peers were unaware they were questioning the gender they were assigned at birth, and noted that much of the contemporary terminology surrounding gender identities did not exist. And I'm asking that because as you read that section where she talks about, you know, there was a controversy about whether to include the T after along with LGB. And what's your sense of when that term came into the common vernacular?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because it's what I'm writing about now in my new book. Let's look back to 1953. Marilyn Monroe was the biggest sex star in the world, and this country didn't even know how to deal with her. Here was this incredibly sexy woman who was also smart and sensitive, and she was a really good actress. And the world wasn't ready to deal with a woman that everybody wanted, who was challenging gender norms by making fun of herself in a certain way in her comedies, but was also truly an artist. And as a man of 68, I remember growing up on the East Coast, where gay people were looked upon as freaks. They were acceptable. We were acceptable if we served some sort of function as social lubricants, if we were decorators or caterers or amusing or designers. But what a long way we've come. And it's because of men and women who simply refused to accept the way that they were imaged. And I think Max is a perfect example of that. People who had the courage to say, I am not some two-dimensional object that you can classify, codify, and look down on. I'm a human being. And I think that the transgender people in particular are tremendously inspiring right now, because as a nation on a planet that's dying ecologically, we have got to stop sweating the small stuff. Who the hell cares what you do in your private life, who you have fun with, who your friends are, what race they are, color or creed or religion? Thank God we've got a black president. I love him. But I'm also really moved when I read Max's book. And if I were running the country, it would be required reading at every school, because we have got to realize that whether there's a gender binary in the West or whether we can learn from the religions and traditions of the East, where things are much more mutable and fluid, still, we're stuck in a primitive mode as long as we keep dividing people instead of looking to learn and grow on the basis of what other people have to teach us and show us by their lives.
That's Adrian Brooks, editor and author of several essays within the book The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. We're going to take a very short break, but when we come back, Adrian, I would love for you to read, since you were talking about artists and women who challenged roles. I would love you to read a little bit from your chapter about Isadora Duncan. That was Adrian Brooks there. This is Eric Jansen live with you on Thursday evening here on Out on the Bay. This Way Out, by the way, will be heard next week at its usual time. We have a special hour-long edition tonight. You can get this book, The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism, edited by Adrian Brooks, who we just heard from, and one of the contributors, Max Wolf Valerio, who's also on this interview that was taped on Tuesday night. for a $120 donation to KALW by calling 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917, or going online to KALW.org. The book is really fascinating. Just today I read an essay by Patricia Nell Warren, author of The Frontrunners, about Bayard Rustin, Martin Luther King's right-hand man, who is credited for organizing King's 1963 March on Washington. He had to keep his gayness under wraps for the good of the racial civil rights movement. And I learned so much more about him today in the 7-page essay. It's one of 31 essays in this new anthology. So do yourself a favor, get The Right Side of History, and support KALW and Out in the Bay all at once. Again, the number is 800-525-9917, or go online to KALW.org. Thank you very, very much for supporting this great community asset.
The number to call is 800-525-9917. $120 contribution, and we will send you The Right Side of History by Adrian Brooks. This is a history book of queer activism in a series of revealing close-ups, first-person accounts, and intimate snapshots of LGBT pioneers and radicals. Eric, I guess not a whole lot has been written about the history of queer activism and LGBT pioneers.
And there's this thought that the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969 started it all off, but there was things way before that. Adrian Brooks next is going to read a section from his essay about Isadora Duncan, the radical communist bisexual dancer. So let's get back to that, and meanwhile, give us a call at 800-525-9917 or go online to KALW.org. Thank you.
Before reading the beginning of the book, I'd just like to point out that this book begins with a woman, a fantastic woman that I'll read about, Isadora Duncan, the dancer. It crests with Miss Major Griffin Gracie telling the story of Stonewall, which is revolutionary because until now, gay white men have squatted on that history, and Miss Major was there, a woman of color. And it ends with Rita Mae Brown talking about Diana Nyad's swim from Cuba to Florida. So not only are women central to this book, it's also fully inclusive of every race and sexual or gender preference, with the exception of people who have always been heterosexual white males. The first chapter is about called The Divine Content of Isadora Duncan, and this is how it begins. Baring her breasts and waving a bright scarf, Isadora announced her bisexuality to a horrified Boston audience and shouted, "This scarf is red, and so am I." It was 1922. It's doubtful if anyone could trump Isadora Duncan as an artistic genius, free spirit, and influence on 20th century arts. As a theorist, choreographer, and performer, she elevated dance to the status of major art, one of its transformative exponents. But the beautiful, romantic, and self-described freedom fighter was even more. By 1900, Isadora was advocating liberation of the body and its unity with a holistic self, the full equality of the sexes, free love, and social and political revolution. As a radical, she saw not just dance, but movement itself as emblematic of spiritual truth, the vehicle to a greater harmony and union with pantheistic divinity. Freewheeling and impulsive, idealistic, courageous, and iconoclastic, Isadora smashed all prior concepts of art, as well as those of the female artist. Her destiny was to startle, stir, shock, outrage, liberate, inspire, and illuminate, while in pursuit of a dream, one which she achieved for others, if not, ultimately, for herself. Isadora advocated principles that proved to be 100 years ahead of their time, but the passionate crusader was more than the passionate crusading was more than the divine discontent without which no artist can hope to succeed. It revealed a fire as timeless as her wish to inspire, to discover and create, and also to challenge and confront the Philistines. Dance was rigid, formal, and ritualistic when she began, not a mode of personal expression, but inspired by classical Greek art and her lifelong love of the sea, Isadora devised a radical new approach. What we are trying to accomplish, he said, is to blend together a poem, a melody, a dance, so that you will not listen to the music, see the dance, or hear the poem, but live in the scene. In addition to revolutionary breakthroughs such as sinuous movements, a theory of fall and recovery, ebbs and flows, contraction and release, and dynamism, Isadora issued strident pronouncements. She was among the first to see the link between dance and the human spirit, to recognize that dance rhythms are created by gravity. Yet even while winning acclaim for performances related to character, situation, and theme, her primary interest was in education, bringing up children to celebrate beauty and live in affiliation to a deeply felt dream of the perfect life. For Isadora, art was a decidedly non-commercial mission. Her calling was to illuminate life by connecting movement to emotion and emotion to truth and freedom.
So after she died tragically when her scarf wrapped around a spokes of a sports car wheel in 1927, you have in the end of your essay here, in London, a dance critic eulogized, "Thanks to her, we are not afraid of nudity." And the San Francisco Chronicle headline ran, "Something mighty fine about Isadora." She rattled things in many ways. So she was really shocking at the time.
Completely shocking. And look where we are today. The Tea Party, Republicans, right-wing people want to make us ashamed of our bodies. It's not just a question of being male or female or lesbian or gay or whatever. There are a whole lot of people who really think that sex is bad, that nudity is something to be ashamed of, that passion or feelings or freedom are something to be denied and suppressed. Let's remember what this country was founded to become. It was founded to provide equal rights for everybody and the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have a Puritan tradition in this country that is still seeking to deny African Americans the vote, to deny women the freedom of choice, and if the Republicans got control of government again, I don't doubt that they would try to deny LGBT people not only the right to marry, but to adopt children and maybe even the right to serve in the military. We have a real opposition to the simple expression of being human and being able to love. She was against all that, and she was a tremendous role model for artists and for women. She was liberated.
I want to ask a little bit about your process. Where did you get all the information? And this applies to you as well, Max, in regards to Jack C. Jackson, who we're going to hear about in a minute.
Sure.
But where did you get the information about Isadora, for example, and the other people who you write about and the essays that you've actually written in your book? And by the way, the book, let me remind folks, is The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. Edited and some essays authored by Adrian Brooks and Max Wolf Valeria was also with me here. He wrote two essays in the book.
To answer that question, I would just have to say, I think every artist, no matter what field they're in, whether they're singers or poets or writers or painters, deal with some core issues in themselves which help them make sense of the world. I'm 67, soon to be 68. I was a hippie, an anti-war activist, a volunteer for Dr. King, and have always been interested in culture and the relationship of spirituality to sex and personal growth and its relationship to political and social change. So some of the people that I write about are people that I've loved ever since I was little, like Isadora Duncan. But I'm happy to say that doing this book and setting out to do it brought me into contact with some incredible people like Miss Major Griffin Gracie and Max and others, some of them very famous, like Evan Wolfson, who just shepherded marriage equality to the Supreme Court. But I've also was terribly moved, I think everybody was, by the torture and killing, the savage, brutal death of Matthew Shepard. And I'm very glad that his mother agreed to take part in this book and write and talk about his life, and that other people like James Gilliam, who's the head of the ACLU in Southern California, has written about the bullying that's going on in our schools, and that Julie Rhode, who's the director of the Names Project, or the AIDS Quilt, writes about the people who have died from AIDS. These aren't people that I knew before, but they're all part of what is leading and has led to a real growth in consciousness in this country. And that's what I really care about.
And so did you have some process where you solicited submissions for this book? And so that's why there's some people in here that you didn't know about yourself before, right?
Yes. And there are a lot of people that I approached, and even some who sent me chapters that I rejected, because we live in a society where LGBT teens are killing themselves at record numbers. I really feel it's incumbent on adults, especially people who are articulate in some way, to help save these kids. So when I approached everyone, Max is a perfect example, I was really curious about them. But I also said from the get-go, I don't want academic gobbledygook. I want every single chapter in this book to be one that if an LGBT teen at risk happened to read it, they would think, God, I belong somewhere. There are people out there who would understand me if I can survive junior high school or high school and just get someplace safe. There will be a community that I belong to, and I come from a heritage and a legacy that's something to be proud of. So that was what guided me, and I'm really pleased and honored, and it's changed me from being sort of a solitary writer to being more engaged with people who've become my friends.
It's fantastic. That's Adrian Brooks, editor of The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. I'm Eric Jansen on Out in the Bay. Adrian is my guest, along with Max Wolf Valerio, who wrote two essays in the book, and one of them is about somebody that I had never heard about until I read the essay last night. So, Max, tell us about Jack C. Jackson, Jr.
Well, I didn't know about Jack C. Jackson, Jr., either until Adrian introduced me to him. And basically, what I did was I interviewed him over Skype, and we talked about his life. He was a state senator from Arizona. I believe he was the second Navajo state senator from Arizona. And he was also appointed by Obama in the State Department, right? You would know.
I think his title is the Special Advisor to the State Department on Native American Affairs.
Yes. So he's had quite the career in government, and he is a Navajo. They're also called Diné, but we talked about it, and he said Navajo is fine. So basically, I wanted to know from him, what was your journey like as a gay man? And he's also about our age, about my age. Mm-hmm. Kind of baby boomer, late baby boomer.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So I'll read from the essay now.
Great, thank you.
Okay. It's called A Hero in Search of a Myth. The room is filled with young Navajo women gathered in a house on a remote area inside the sprawling Navajo Nation, the largest Native American reservation in the United States. Jack C. Jackson, Jr. is visiting the house with his boyfriend, a young man he met in Washington, D.C., where he has been working and continuing the legacy of public service established by his father, Jack C. Jackson, Sr., a state senator in the Arizona State Legislature. Holding hands with his boyfriend openly in that house, Jack searches the faces and forms of the women surrounding him. Slowly, Jack feels overcome with a dawning apprehension. The bodies and faces of the women reveal a hidden dimension. These women, dressed in feminine clothing and holding themselves with grace and a seemingly inborn intuition of their own female being, are actually biological males. They are, apparently, living as women. And as Jackson Jr. was to discover later, they are not taking estrogen and have not had surgery to alter their biological sex. Jackson Jr. finds himself and his boyfriend suddenly alone, starkly masculine in a small sea of feminine energy. He feels unsure. Should he even be at this house visiting this gathering? Then one of the women emerges from the others. She approaches the couple in a beeline, her face set in a serious expression. She admonishes Jack, saying, "We are very offended by how you guys are acting toward one another. We don't show affection to another male." She points to his clasped hand, which is gently holding his boyfriend's. "We don't do that here." Jack would later recall and describe these unusual Navajo women as, quote, young ladies, because they were indeed feminine and only detectable as biologically male after a long, intent look across the group at their forms and faces. They were not by any measure gay men in their culture, and they were also not transgender in any modern Western sense, since they were not following a Western medical paradigm of therapy, sex hormone surgery, and reintegration into the world as women. These young women were holding the traditional Navajo role of Nadli. Now, I may be mispronouncing that, but so it's Nadleehe, or biological males who lived in the traditional female role. Nadli dress as women and essentially live their lives as women, marrying heterosexual men and performing the traditional Navajo role of cleaning, cooking, and supporting their husband as his wife. In order to integrate his strong identity as Navajo and his experience as a gay man, Jack sought a traditional role for a Navajo man attracted to other men, but he was not to find it. He would have to continue his search on his own, both part of and yet apart from his people's traditional view of gender and sexuality. Instead, Jackson learned about being a gay man in the larger American society of the mid-70s after he left the reservation. During that time, he went to university and lived in Phoenix, where he experienced gay life in the bars, events, and gatherings there.
And this ends with a little bit about his father, who was very opposed to, same-sex marriage. And the Navajo Nation is on record against same-sex marriage, correct?
I haven't kept up. I'm sorry.
I believe so. I'm not absolutely certain myself, but I believe I heard a story in NPR recently about that.
Yeah,
but it sounds like in your essay, his father has sort of perhaps softened a little bit.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think his father has softened. He was basically he admonished him that, you know, that things were binary and that you needed a female and that, you know, everything was male. There was a male wind and female wind, right, traditionally. But at some point, I think he did come to a deeper understanding and an acceptance of his son and I believe also a spiritual connection. Which possibly was a pan-Indian spiritual connection because they were also connected with the Native American church. So there was a medicine man, apparently, who was connected with the Native American church, which is not necessarily a Navajo church. But anyway, he told Jack Jackson Sr. that your son is special. And he said he was destined to go on and do good things.
And that's when he was a young boy.
So, you know, there was apparently an understanding that was reached. But I think the interesting thing about that essay, and I'm a half Blackfoot Indian myself. My mother is from the Blood Reserve in Alberta, Canada. So the interesting thing is that, you know, I think there's a lot of stereotypes out there that basically all Indians are just, you know, we're automatically all seen as shamans, you know, if we're gay or trans. But it's not quite that simple, you know. And I think a lot of us still have to go through a journey of acceptance and searching.
Both within your own communities and within yourselves. And
yeah,
within the larger
and outside in the world at,
sure,
at large.
Sure, sure. Adrian.
I'd like to add to that because I think what Max says is very true. And two of the other chapters in the book are written by amazing people. One is written by an African-American man named Sultan Shakir, who is not only African-American and gay, he's also a Muslim and was raised Muslim and grew up and came of age after 9/11. And the second chapter that I'd like to refer to is written by a man named Tiger DeVore, and his essay is about intersex people and the effort of intersex groups. He's maybe the most prominent person in the country, he's been on Oprah, to stop the genital mutilation of babies that are born intersex when their parents or well-intentioned doctors carve up their genitals when they're born and deprive them of the right to choice. This isn't just a one in a million. This is one in every 2,000 children. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that people like this present our country with a very interesting challenge. And it's not just the country. If you look at what's happening in Europe right now with Muslim people fleeing the war in the Middle East or famine in Africa or wars in Africa, trying to move in to democratic societies that are really in crisis over whether to accept them. Here in this country, we may not be plagued by war, but we have a lot to do in terms of coming to understand that our Muslim citizens are not terrorists, and our intersex people have to be accepted and understood, not marginalized, and not thought less of.
I want to thank you both so much for being here. This book has an incredible diversity. As I said, 30 chapters in here from all different sorts of people across the LGBTQI spectrum. The Right Side of History, 100 Years of LGBTQI Activism. Thank you so much, Max Wolf-Valerio and Adrian Brooks, for being here.
It was a pleasure.
One last little thing is, how can people find out more about this book?
Go online. Okay. Go on Amazon.
And look for
The Right Side of History.
Right Side of History. Yep. Adrian Brooks, you'll find it. It'll come up. I'm sure they'll find something if they look up Max Valerio, Max Wolf-Valerio. Something will come up as well.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, thank you so much.
I'm proud to be in the book. And
it's fantastic, and I'm so happy that your publisher has donated a few copies for us to give away to our listeners as a thank you gift. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. If you missed part of tonight's broadcast or just want to hear the whole thing again, you can on our website, outinthebay.org. It should be posted within an hour or so after broadcast. While you're there at outinthebay.org, sign up for free weekly podcasts, hear past shows, and download the Stitcher app to hear us on mobile devices. It's all free at outinthebay.org. And subscribe on our website, on our Facebook page, or both. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime, and thanks very much to tonight's studio engineer, Debbie Kennedy. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening.